Pyrrhus of Epirus, the Battle of Heraclea, Background, Part 1, The Roman Army. Now, the coming battle between Pyrrhus and the Romans would be the first clash of arms between a Hellenistic king and this newly emerging Italian power. It would also be the first battle between two different military systems, the Macedonian, which was created by Philip and Alexander the Great, and of course the Romans. During its war with its Italian neighbors, Rome's military tactics and equipment had undergone considerable change. Initially, its infantry had been armed with a traditional hoplite-style equipment, a spear, some body armor, a helmet, and a large shield. Roman army would have fought in a close-packed phalanx, with each man able to support his neighbor with a shield. The Rome's Etruscan overlords and enemies may have taught them this method of fighting. It was also the method of fighting of many of its other foes, namely the Latins, the Campanians, and obviously the Greeks. Battles were fought on open plains and decided by a clash of the opposing phalangites in a similar fashion in such battles as you would have had in the Greek cities. From the writings of Greek historians and poets, we have some idea of the course of such battles. Most often, the two sides would line up, march towards one another. The battle would inevitably be decided by a clash of two infantry lines. If both sides' morale held up, there would be a terrible collision as the two lines smashed into one another. Sometimes, if one side's nerve failed, the initial impact would decide the battle. If, however, the first clash failed to break one side, the fighting could degenerate into a pushing match. Eventually, one side would prevail, either by superior numbers, courage, or formation. The other side would break and flee the battlefield. This moment of collapse was the most dangerous. The beaten side would expose its unprotected rear to the enemy, and it was here that the heaviest casualties often occurred. Pursuit was usually short due to the exhaustion of the victors. And one of the things that comes in later battles, you get into the time of Julius Caesar and Augustus, you can look out on the battlefield according to accounts, and you can see where the hardest fighting took place because the mound of bodies would be bigger there. There's some discussion with this with the accounts of the Battle of Zama afterwards, but you can see where the fighting was the most difficult. And this idea of this is the spot where the fighting was the hottest and where the enemy broke is sometimes commemorated by the Greeks by what is known as a trophy. That is basically a monument at the spot where the enemy fled. So there's some interesting things done early on. Now, I've been to the Etruscan Museum in the Vatican, which is one of the best, and the one in Florence, and their equipment of the Etruscan warriors is exactly like what you would find the Greeks using against the Persians. So it's really interesting that you would see this same set of armor, but of course you've got Magna Graecia down there, you've got those Greek states. Those city-states in the area would have recognized the superiority of their equipment and adopted it. Now, this method of fighting that it previously described was effective so long as both sides adhered to the same tactical system. Many of Rome's enemies, however, did not adhere to these rules of engagement. The Italian hill tribes, given the broken nature of their terrain, tended to fight in looser formations and smaller units. They preferred to shower their enemies with javelins from afar and give ground when pressed. Ambushes and skirmishing were their normal method of fighting, rather than a straightforward battle of close-order spearmen. If such troops could be forced into the open battle, they would usually be beaten by the phalanx, but this could be difficult to achieve. Now, if you wanted to see how this might have appeared without all the fancy equipment, the opening battle scene in the movie Gladiator, which is set in Central Europe against the Dacians, they're fighting in the woods. They have to get them out of the woods so they can deal with them in a more orderly manner. And then their cavalry can come in at the end. So this is similar to what's going on here. It just takes place later. The other enemies the Romans faced from 390 BC onward were the Gauls. Now, the Celtic method, which the Gauls were Celtic, was, again, different. According to ancient writers, it consisted of a mad rush preceded by a shower of javelins to bring the Gauls into hand-to-hand combat. They then fought as individuals, slashing at their enemies with long swords. Their size and ferocity intimidated their smaller southern neighbors. Such a charge could sweep away the inflexible hoplite phalanx. In the Galatian invasion of Greece in 279, the Greek hoplite phalanx could notwithstand the fierce charge of Celtic Galatians. The success of the Gauls against the Etruscans and the Romans in the early 4th century suggests that they had a similar problem. The Romans, after their experiences fighting both the Gauls and the hill tribes, adapted their tactics and their equipment. This is something that the Romans do throughout their history, is they adapt and change. And what they did to deal with the Gauls and the hill tribes, they broke their infantry up into smaller units of about 120 men, called maniples, which translate to handfuls. These were more flexible and could maneuver to support one another. They also deployed in three lines rather than in the traditional one. The first line was now used to break up the enemy attack. It could then fall back through the gaps in the maniples of the second line or be reinforced by them. The reserve line could then renew the assault on the enemy. They also rearmed the troops of the first line with throwing spears and a new shield called the scutum. This was a longer, narrower shield, giving more protection to the wielder, but unlike the hoplite shield, none to his neighbor. At this stage, certainly before 290 BC, the throwing spear had become the much heavier pilum. Although of shorter range, it had the advantage that if it struck an enemy shield, its weight would render the shield useless. Troops so armed were now fought more individually, with sword and shield rather than as a phalanx. They also fought more in the open and in shallower formations. The attack would begin with a shower of thrown spears, followed up by a charge into contact using sword and shield. The second line, the princeps, were also rearmed with a pilum at some stage, although at the time of Pyrrhus, we're not really sure. The third line, the triarii, although maintaining the thrusting spear, also adapted the scutum. Now, Livy describes how this new formation worked. Quote, "When the battle formation of the army was completed, the Hetestai were the first to engage. If they failed to repulse the enemy, they slowly retired through the intervals between the companies of the princeps, who then took up the fight. The Hetestai following in their rear, the triarii, meantime, were resting on one knee under their standards, their shields over their shoulders, and their spears planted in the ground with the points upwards, giving them the appearances of a bristling palisade. If the princeps were also unsuccessful, they would slowly retire to the triarii, which has given rise to the proverbial saying, when people are in great difficulty, matters come down to the triarii. When the triarii have admitted the Hetestai and the princeps through the intervals separating their companies, they rose from their kneeling position and instantly, closing their companies up, they blocked all passages through them and in one compact mass fell on the enemy as the last hope of the army. The enemy who had followed up the others as though they had defeated them saw a dread new and larger army rising apparently out of the earth." End of quote. That the Romans actually fought in three lines, checkerboard formation style, is disputed by later scholars. It has been argued that such broken formation would have been swept away by a more compact enemy line, as they would push through and outflank the isolated Roman maniples. Therefore, the argument goes that the Romans must have formed a single front line before contact with the enemy. But this is not supported by any of the ancient sources. And Goldsworthy, one of the great modern historians on the Romans, points out that an enemy advancing through the gaps in the Roman first line would be confronted by the princeps of the second line. If they turned to take the Hetestai flanks with their own flanks, they would be in danger. Now, hand-to-hand combat carrying protective armor was extremely fatiguing, emotionally stressful, and much more tentative than is often thought. The usual way to get the enemy line to collapse was to force a gap in it and then attack the exposed flanks of the enemy. To do this, soldiers would have to press forward into any gaps in an enemy line caused by casualties before they could be filled in by the rear ranks. To do so, however, required considerable courage, as those pressing forward would be surrounded by the enemy. If the initial clash did not decide the battle, then the two sides would separate and rest. It was then up to their officers to get them to renew the struggle. The longer the battle went on, the more difficult it would become. This is when the Roman method of holding troops in reserve gave them the advantage, as fresh troops would be more willing to renew the struggle. The Roman method of raising armies also changed at this time. Troops were now organized into legions, as well as heavy infantry. Each legion, including included light infantry, levies, rotari, and another class, the Ascensi. The exact nature of the Ascensi is not known. They were most likely either poorly armed camp servants or camp guards equipped with a spear and a shield. Livy describes them as those, quote, who were least to be dependent upon and were therefore placed in the rearmost line, end of quote. The total numbers in each legion were usually about 5,000 infantry, 300 cavalry. The usual size of a Roman consular army were two legions of Romans and two legions or more of allies, such as the Latins or others. And the size of this army would often be increased in order to meet more serious threats. Now, these changes in armaments and tactics made the Roman infantry line more flexible and better able to deal with the tactics of their opponents. The exact date of all of these changes, however, is unknown, but they were certainly in place by the time of Pyrrhus's invasion. And at another time, I want to talk about how many soldiers that were available to the Romans, because one of the things Pyrrhus remarks is he'll beat the Romans and beat the Romans and beat the Romans, and then a new army shows up. And there's a discussion that do the Romans come out of trees? Do they grow in the forest? Where do these people come from? So there is a discussion, but we do have, there is some ancient records of population and tax structure that I'll talk about at another time. Now, the sources for this, Plutarch's Lives by Plutarch, Pyrrhus of Epirus by Champion, Wars of Alexander's Successors, Volume 1 and 2, by Bennett and Roberts, History of Rome by Livy, obviously, the Ancient Warfare magazine, Volume 13, Issue 1, and Ancient Warfare, Volume 6, Issue 4. One has an article on Heraclea, one has an article about Pyrrhus's army and the Roman armies as well. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.